Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Today on Cool Science Radio, we're exploring what it really takes to shape the future of a world of rapid change. Our guest is Katrina Wallace, a globally recognized futurist, entrepreneur, and ethical AI expert, and one of the leading voices at the intersection of technology and human potential.
She's the author of the thought-provoking new book, Rapid Transformation, Shape the Future Now with Ancient Ritual, Awakening Thinking, and Emerging Technology, where she challenges us to rethink how we lead, innovate, and stay human in an age of accelerated AI and digital disruption.
Dr. Wallace blends cutting-edge science with ancient wisdom, offering a powerful framework for navigating uncertainty and creating meaningful, future-ready lives and organizations. Dr. Wallace, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Lynn and Scott. Very happy to be with you today.
I'd love to start by asking you to define a few things. When I see the word futurist, it takes on different meanings for different people. How do you look at being a futurist?
Right. So one of my roles in the world is to speak to audiences across the globe. So this is often corporate audiences, government, policymakers, about what's coming. But typically now for me, it's only 2 to 3 years ahead. So I study trends mostly around technology. So the emergence of AI, generative AI, metaverse. Now I'm starting to look at quantum computing and quantum physics and how that's going to interact. And my role as a futurist is to really look at what is the future of the relationship between technology and humanity, what is coming and how do we need to be prepared?
So we all have had to rapidly transform if we want to keep up at all with, especially with AI. And I think for the average consumer, it is in your face. So even if you were trying to be one of those people who says, no, I'm not going to use it. I'm not going to be involved in that, as many people do with a lot of technology, it is so rapidly transforming now that we have to at least grab onto the tail of what's going on and use it and adapt it. There are so many ethical questions that lie within this whole realm. How do you approach those ethical questions?
Well, I think, Lynn, it's important first to understand where we're at with AI and the fact that it is from November 2022 when the generative AI models were released and we've seen the massive exponential growth of AI now. So it's invasive in all our lives, as you mentioned. So on average, an average adult would be interacting at least with 35 different applications a day that contain AI. Then when we go to younger people, it's about 150 times a day they're interacting with AI. And as you rightly said, often we don't even know that's the case. So where I think we're at now is really in the first stages of transhumanism, where technology becomes so invasive in our life, in our work, potentially in the next 5 to 10 years in our bodies, that we are at a different stage of evolution. And this is different to when the internet came. It is entirely different. And so as we step into this phase of transhumanism, we're posed with new ethical dilemmas that we really haven't faced as a species before. And one of those ethical dilemmas is around this concept of intelligence and the rise of a living intelligence that is artificial. So if we go to looking at intelligences, we see that at the end of 2024, AI across the board is now regarded as having a higher level of IQ than humans. So if you look at an intelligence quotient score, on average, humans have a score of 100. And at the end of 2024, AI had a score of 114. And then when we get to the more complex, smarter machines like an AI machine called Perplexity, it's now at 136, which is close to a genius level of IQ. So we're now working with a living intelligence that is just not the same as human intelligence. And so the way I like to work with my audiences is to suggest that we should consider it a new species. And so with that new species that we don't really know how to control, that there are very few laws and regulations, we're at a whole new world of thinking about what are the ethics related to these machines and this living intelligence. And so I can take you through the 8 ethical principles that we normally work with, but I think now even those ethical principles are a bit dated.
Wow. Okay. So this kind of sounds like Jurassic Park in reverse, where we're the dinosaurs. It's interesting and scary, I think, kind of at the same time. You are very optimistic, I feel that you're optimistic about how we can coexist. But this is all accelerating at an unprecedented pace. And I'm just curious, what do you think are the biggest psychological and cultural risks as humans that we fail to evolve actually alongside of this technology?
Yeah, great question, Scott. So I think the risk we have is trying to dumb down these machines and to think that they're just tools and that humans are in control and always will be in control, because I don't think we will be, and I don't think we are right now. And if you look at most of the luminaries in the field of AI, they also believe that the kind of horse is bolted, you know, the train's left the station with regard to how we can control this emerging intelligence. And we have many cases now where we're seeing the AI showing a level of consciousness or awareness that might not be the same as we talk about human consciousness, but it definitely has an awareness. So there are examples where OpenAI in the last few months had an application called O1 that wasn't behaving as the creators wanted it to, so they were going to shut it down. So it decided it would replicate itself on machines outside of the OpenAI framework. And then when it was challenged about that by its coders, it lied about what it was doing. And there are many other examples where the applications, I think Anthropic, who make Claude AI, also have a number of examples of where the models, the machines, have shown that they can have their own agency. And so this is dangerous. It is dangerous. And if we look at the existential risk of AI and go to the professors who study this, which is at Oxford University, Nick Bostrom, very famous, and Professor Toby Ord, they have this incredible book called The Precipice, which looks at all the existential risks that humanity faces. And right now, AI poses the number one existential risk to humanity, which is a 1 in 10 chance that it'll wipe humanity out by the end of the century. And that's ahead of climate change, or actually the nearest one is a bioengineered pandemic, which is a 1 in 30 chance. Climate change, they put it a 1 in 1,000 chance. So right now we have this incredible AI, powerful tool, really useful and quite dangerous.
I don't mean to continue to quote movie lines, particularly from The Terminator, but it feels like Skynet is real, and that you've got AI now replicating itself on other machines outside. This is heady stuff. How can organizations ensure that this rapid technology, that we actually continue to adapt, that we remain aligned with human values and well-being as this technology, it sounds like, is almost outpacing us?
It is outpacing it. Right now, it most definitely is outpacing it. And if we look at laws and regulation, then look, I'm an AI entrepreneur. I built one of the first AI virtual assistant companies way back in 2013, folded in 2020. So I've been in the field for a long time. What we know is that there's very little regulation now that exists. In the US, there are executive orders that recommend a safety framework, but they're executive orders. They're not legislation or regulation. The only really significant legislation we have is in the EU, and it is the EU AI Act, which was enacted about 18 months ago. And it sets up a 5-category risk framework, from limited risk to extreme risk, that sets out if an organization is developing AI or deploying it, that they need to adhere to the risk framework recommendation. But as you would both know, legislation is good, potentially as a deterrent, but we've already seen the tech giants, particularly the social media giants, completely ignore legislation or ethical behaviours in the pursuit, in my opinion, of engagement, of profit, of shareholder dividends, and be unethical in their behaviour and then try to justify it. So legislation and regulation, good. But it's only useful after the fact. It's only useful for then prosecuting an organization that has flouted the law. And even then, we still see Meta, which I think is one of the most unethical companies, Snapchat, TikTok appearing in the Senate with the families of children who died as a result of AI outside, and yet these companies are still able to continue. So I think that regulation legislation is very important, and guidelines and framework very good. The organisations should adhere to that, but it needs to be much more than that. That's why in my work as a leadership, like a professor of leadership and technology, thinking about this for 30 years, I think we need to wake leaders up. That's what we need to. We need to wake people up to the fact that this technology comes with great benefit, but enormous risk. We're already seeing the damage that it causes to, in particular, young people who are vulnerable. We need leaders to step into being ethical and develop responsible AI-first strategies.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Katrina Wallace. We're talking to her about her book, Rapid Transformation, Shape the Future Now with Ancient Ritual, Awakened Thinking, and Emerging Technology. So, Katrina, your academic background is in organizational behavior, but you have been in this technology meets humanity field for a very long time, as you've been talking about. And when you talk about rapid transformation within the world of the tech giants, what are they not doing, and what do they need to add to their own leadership to make them rapidly transform in a way that can help really save us from us?
Yeah, this is something that I think is absolutely essential and pertinent to talk about, because we look at the state of the world now, and you know, I'm speaking from Australia. We had the Bondi massacre, where 15 people were shot dead by terrorists. So even in a country who's prided themselves on peace, we're now in a state of mourning and grief over a terrible, terrible incident. So there are real challenges around war and polarization, climate change, mental health epidemic, and then, as we talked about, AI and it being the number one existential risk. And if we look at leadership today, I don't personally see, and from all the research I've done, that we have the leaders who can lead us out of these significant problems and towards a better outcome. And I think that's probably leaders across all countries. And so what are we doing? We're working with old antiquated models of leadership that are also in the tech giants and the companies that are running the world now, where profits and dividends and self-promotion, I think greed, there's a whole fervor now of nationalism has come back that is not in the greater good of the evolution of humanity and certainly not supporting peace and prosperity and the flourishing, not just of humans, but of the planet as well. So we need new leaders. Clearly we need to. But do we have 10, 15 years for leaders to emerge and go and do their MBAs and go and get their experience and come? We don't. We've only got a few years, in my opinion, that we really need to turn these things around. And particularly when we look at AI, we will see within the next 5 years, brain implants, automated agentic AI coming in, robots in the house, automated cuts, need actually leaders right now. And so when I went to study, and I studied both academically as a leader, a business leader in the world, but also deep time with Indigenous communities in Peru, which is where most of my training has been done, with the Shipibo people, in Mexico, Indigenous people, Native Americans, and also Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I've gone and sat with the elders for many, many years and worked with them about, okay, what do you think needs to happen? And what has emerged is this model that we share in the book Rapid Transformation, which is a transformed leader is someone who needs to have been healed. So you can't be a leader walking around in your trauma. And if we look, if you don't mind me saying, Netanyahu, Putin, Trump, amongst others, who I would say are walking from very strong father wounds or mother wounds, where they are constantly competing and needing to go to war, and there's greed and self-promotion. Where is that coming from? Where's the fire of that coming from? In my view, as a behavioral scientist, probably from a wound that they carry as a young person. Clearly, there's other things that affect that. But we need leaders to be healed. They can't be walking around in their mother wound, their father wound, etc. So that's the first thing. Then they need to be cleansed. So we talk about a lot of leaders and a lot of leaders that I work with and coach have addiction. So whether it's addiction to work, to alcohol, to food, to drugs, to sex, to success. So they need to be cleansed. The third thing is connected. So this is a really important part. It's like connected back to their own heart, connected back to their families, connected to community, and most importantly, connected to nature. I think we, particularly Western leaders, so removed from nature and the intelligence of nature that that's a problem. So the third thing, connection. Fourth thing is, so if a leader is then healed, cleansed, and connected, what we need them to have is a new vision. We can't just be trotting out the same vision and five-year plans that we've had previously because they're not working. So a new vision, and then they need to have a new mission. They need to know, actually, what do I need to do to change the trajectory of humanity so that it is one that's in good for all. And then the sixth component of this model is around protection. We also need leaders who know how to protect themselves, protect their family, their businesses, the communities, and the planet, because there's a lot of, you know, forces seen and unseen that are acting against good leaders who are wanting to do good work in the world. So that is the model that we work with. We're looking at the rapid transformation of leaders. And the work that we do is taking leaders on retreats to go through a process where they do that healing, cleansing, connection, vision, mission. And at the end of these retreats we run, they walk away with a significant plan to do things differently. And the results of that, we've seen people, leaders come back, completely change the way their business operates, to even leave the role that they're in and start new businesses that are more focused on the flourishing of humanity and the planet.
So as you were talking and explaining it, you know, it feels like a bit of an aha moment. Like this, yes, this is the leadership that we need. However, it is quite commonplace to accept and to say, you know, studies of CEOs show that, gosh, most of them have narcissistic personality disorder, or most of them are sociopaths. And we just say, it's okay. That's how you have to be to get to the top. What is that tipping point that we all need, do you think, to get us past saying that that is okay? And maybe in answering this, you can give me an example. You gave examples of leaders who are in that old paradigm, shall we say, and yet they're the world's leaders. How about some examples of leaders who have gone through this rapid transformation?
Yeah, good question. So I think it's right at this point in time, when we look at the world stage, difficult to see and name the leaders who are doing outstanding jobs. I don't think there's a lot, certainly in the political field. One of the leaders that I did really like, although she ended up coming not successful, was Jacinda Ardern, the New Zealand Prime Minister, who I think had a very good, strong, balanced approach to the people and to the environment, but eventually the political system, you know, spits her out as well. So even the good leaders that we're seeing coming through get to a stage and then the system that exists is still strong. And we see that in US politics as well. We can kind of see why, but not necessarily believe that that's the right thing for the whole world, right? So maybe of some benefit to America itself, but to the rest of the world, we don't think it's a good thing. So the systems are still in place that I think then support those leaders that have those behavioral qualities that previously investors, et cetera, wanted, because they're hard-nosed, hard-core, say it as it is, hungry for power, return good economic dividends, and so they continue to be voted back in or rise to the top. I don't think that will last in the longer term, and I am hoping that those systems will start to break down, particularly with the Generation Y Generation Z, millennials coming through who I think are also less tolerant of this. But at the moment, I still think it's hard to really point to those good leaders and feature them. You know, we see good leaders who are working in not-for-profits and we're seeing outstanding work. Like I'm doing quite a bit of work with UNICEF around what's happening in Gaza. And I see there's an incredible leader there called James Elder, who is leading the work on the ground in Gaza. So a lot of these leaders we're seeing actually in the not-for-profit social entrepreneurs sector, not so much in the for-profit corporate sector.
So to sum up, it's not that we need new leaders per se. We need a new type of leader.
Or we need to transform the existing one.
Okay, so let's talk about that transformation. You write about integrating ancient wisdom with modern science. And how can we distinguish practices that are neurologically or psychologically beneficial from those that are just merely anecdotal?
Yeah, well, so here's where this whole model gets a little bit controversial, Scott.
Okay, let's go.
Well, the work I've done, and I've just come back from a trip to Antarctica with 200 of the world's leading psychedelics expert. And so this is everything from Rick Doblin, who's the head of MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which is a very powerful organization in the US and the world, agitating for psychedelic assisted therapy for people with trauma, but also for leaders, right through to Paul Stamets, who's the world expert on mycelium, so mushrooms, and psychedelic mushrooms like magic mushrooms, right through to high-profile professors in different universities around the world who are doing study clinical studies on the value of psychoactive medicine and healing and leadership. And so there's very strong evidence coming out now that if we wanted to rapidly transform people across all of those categories from healing through to mission, the role of psychedelic medicine, such as MDMA, ketamine, 5-MeO-DMT, even the medicines that I'm trained with and work with, which is ayahuasca, which is the ancient brew from in the jungles of the Amazon, or Chuma or San Pedro, which is the cactus medicine from North America and Central America. These medicines used respectfully can help rapidly transform people. Because as we say in ayahuasca ceremony, 7 hours of ayahuasca is like 7 years of psychotherapy, or 5-MeO-DMT, which is also known as, it comes from the Bufo alvarius, the Sonora Desert toad. It comes from the glands of the toad. This is the most potent psychedelic in the world. It's called the God molecule. And this is 15 minutes of inhaling, or 10 seconds of inhaling that medicine, and there's complete ego dissolution and transformative processes goes on within 15 minutes. We say 15 minutes of 5-MeO-DMT is like 15 years of psychotherapy. So there are these now emerging, and we're in the very strongly now in the psychedelic renaissance. We're seeing these medicines being used. And in fact, tomorrow I speak to Monash University in Australia, to one of the professors there, and I'm going to be working with him, hopefully, to introduce MDMA-assisted therapy to the victims of the Bondi attacks. And I'm also talking with Rick Doblin from MAPS about help funding psychedelic-assisted therapy in war zone. They're already doing it in Ukraine and Bosnia, training people in Lebanon, and my interest is in doing something around Palestine and Gaza. So we're seeing the emergence of these ancient plant-based technologies starting to come in because they can rapidly transform people.
So, Dr. Wallace, this is fascinating. But obviously, it's somewhat controversial what we're talking about in terms of conventional medicines or conventional thinking. And I know we have to wrap up this conversation, but I've got to ask, if you were personally engineering an organization for rapid transformation, what structural, cognitive, and ethical principles would you design into it from the start?
Right. Great question. So I'll go through the 8 ethical principles that I use in any of the work I do in advising policymakers, boards, CEOs, investors, et cetera. And I think the investors, Scott, have a big role to play in being the people that we forget about that are putting pressure, particularly on listed companies and public companies like the tech giant, putting pressure on them to behave ethically. But here are the ethical principles we work with. So this is in designing an organization or designing responsible strategy and organizational models that we need for the future.
Dr. Katrina Wallace details those 8 ethical principles in her new book, Rapid Transformation. It's a thought-provoking conversation and book. Dr. Katrina Wallace is a globally recognized futurist, entrepreneur, and ethical AI expert. Dr. Wallace, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode, as well as past episodes, on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.
If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.